Well, how many of you are ready for Thanksgiving?
Yeah.
You got everything set? Me too. Me too. I don't have a turkey or any of the groceries yet, but that's a part, a pretty minor part, I think, of the whole Thanksgiving thing. My sermon title today is "This Thanksgiving, Don't Drink and Don't Sleep." That's what I took away from Elaine's message. Is that it's the sleeping people who sleep and the people who get drunk. So don't, this Thanksgiving, that's all you got to worry about. Just don't sleep and don't drink and everything will be fine. But before we get into that, I wanted to give you some Thanksgiving stats. Thanksgiving stats. Do you know, they pardon a turkey every year at the White House on Thanksgiving. Do you know who the first president was to pardon a turkey? Any guesses?
Roosevelt,
that's a good guess. That's what I thought too. I was like, it's got to be Roosevelt or Eisenhower or somebody very long ago. It was the first George Bush, George W. Bush, for in 1989. And every year they bring two turkeys and they pardon only one of them. And if they bring two in case something happens to the first one and he does not outlive his pardon, they have a backup turkey. Speaking of turkeys, the Butterball Hotline, have anybody ever called the Butterball Hotline? You know that you can call, there's a hotline, the Butterball, if you have any questions, you don't even have to have a Butterball turkey. Any questions about turkey or Thanksgiving whatsoever, you can call. They field 100,000 calls every year around Thanksgiving about foods. And speaking of food, this is the stats that I got, that this year, people will consume between 3,150 and 4,000 calories on average at a Thanksgiving meal, and 7.2 billion of those calories will be from turkey alone. So just keep track. So I want to know how you fare in that. And then, of course, after you have the meal, it's time for what?
Pie.
Pie, of course. Now, what do you think is the most common pie at Thanksgiving? Apple, pumpkin, pecan. Nope, you're all wrong. The most common pie is this pie called other. I've never had other pie. I didn't know that it was so common. But other pie. But seriously, I looked at this and I thought, okay, this graphic takes into account pumpkin, pecan, apple, sweet potato, chocolate, cherry, and blueberry. Now, I've been to a lot of Thanksgiving meals at a lot of different places. I have never had any other pie than those pies listed. Do you have a lemon meringue pie at Thanksgiving?
No.
No. I've had other pies. But I'm wondering, what pie are you cooking at Thanksgiving? Are you bringing, are you bringing a lemon meringue pie? I'm going to bring this caramel nut peanut butter chocolate pie for Thanksgiving. No, nobody's doing that. So that's, I was wondering, maybe they were taking into account meat pies or something. And this is the last one, that 20% of Americans plan to host Thanksgiving. Anybody hosting Thanksgiving this year? All right, so you should know that 11% of the hosts say they already regret hosting, even before the Thanksgiving has come. But the reason I picked this text from the Thessalonians for our Thanksgiving text is because at the beginning of this book, Paul and the writers are so thankful to the church of Thessalonica. They constantly keep saying, "We are so thankful for you. We are so thankful for you." And so I wanted to kind of puzzle this. Why are the writers so thankful for this church? And so there was a couple of things I got on a background. The first one was that this is the oldest letter in the New Testament. This is actually the oldest book that they believe in the New Testament. It's older than the Gospels, older than Acts, older than any of the other letters written. And one of the ways they assess that is because the letter doesn't just come from Paul. The letter comes from Paul and Timothy and Silvanus. You don't hear a lot about Silvanus in the New Testament. And so whenever I refer to the writers of Thessalonians, I'm going to just refer to them as the writers, because it's not very clear who did most of the writing, although based on the way that the text was, it's probably Paul, and this is an artist's depiction of probably how it was written, with the other people just sort of looking over Paul's shoulder. But the letter does come from all three, so we have to assume that at least they had some influence. And the thing that was unique about this early church is that they were in a culture that was very different from the beliefs and sort of what Paul was trying to instill in the early churches. So the ideas and sort of the cultural milieu of the church that Paul was trying to develop was very different from kind of the society that was around it. And this early church wasn't quite sure how much of the culture they should continue to follow and how much Paul and this gospel was going to change their perspective of the culture around them. Now, I think this is very relevant even in today's world, right? Because so much is influenced by our culture, be it our political culture or consumer culture, or capitalist culture. And I often will see that that culture will sometimes influence the way that people teach in church. And very rarely, the way people in church don't have as much effect on the outside culture. So we have to really be careful that that these two things are not, that one is not completely influencing the other. And so Paul was trying to teach them what was different about them being a church from the Greek culture that was around them, the sort of Hellenistic culture. And so he sets up these different dichotomies, these different illustrations where he says, this is what the world around you is like. But because you have heard this message of Jesus, this is what your world is like. And this is how you are unique, how you are distinct from the culture around you. And so I want to highlight three of those different dichotomies this morning. And the first one is around time. Now, this is from the assistant professor of New Testament at the Luther Seminary. He had this observation. His name is Christopher Van Kaufman. And he was saying that the Greek idea of time in this period, this sort of Hellenistic idea that even though this is under the Roman Empire, this still is very influenced by Greek philosophy. And their version of time was that it was both eternal and cyclical. So time just went on forever, but it was constantly in a period of renewal. Everything repeated. This was most evident in the four seasons, right? That every year the new season came back around, and they would have festivals that marked each of the different seasons. And these festivals would kind of show how everything was being repeated. And this idea of a cycle was how their lives were lived as well. They sort of believed that they were living a kind of life and a kind of world that had come before them. And the world and life of people coming after them would also repeat. Even though they didn't necessarily believe in reincarnation, they sort of believed that everybody would follow this same pattern. And the sort of revolutionary or different way of thinking that Paul has in mind is that because of the coming of Jesus, because of the promise of Jesus to come again, their timeline was very linear, looking forward toward this future point where Jesus would come again. This future point where everything would sort of be upturned and everything would be different. And in fact, their life was meant to strive towards this goal, to make as much change as possible towards seeking that new world, this sort of the new kingdom that Jesus described. And so, to quote Michael McDonald, after Jesus, things will never be the same again. And though this might be seen as something to fear, something that they should be afraid of, right? But Paul was very clear to point out that this was not something to fear, that this was something to anticipate with hope and with excitement, that something was coming that was going to be different from everything they had seen before. So, because time was new, now seen in this way, he sets up a different dichotomy, and that is of calmness and surprise. And he sets this up by saying, the people around you, They're going to be shocked when this happens. The whole world is going to be upturned and they are not going to be prepared for it. But you will not be shocked because you will know that it's coming. And the illustration he uses for this is that of a person going into labor, a woman going into labor. And I couldn't help but think of Renee and I's own journey during this time when Brian was born. Now, she had been pregnant at this point for a number of months. And we knew that it was very likely that she was going to take this baby to term and that she at some point was going to go into labor. And so, we were of course completely prepared for it. Except that Brian came 4 weeks earlier than the doctors told us that he was scheduled to arrive. So we went from the face on the left to the face on the right. And of course, we shouldn't have been shocked by this. You know, they said, well, at a certain point, then the baby can come any time. It's likely that it'll come at this point, but it can come at any point. So when at this point I was sleeping on the couch because every time if I moved it would wake Renee up and she had just terrible insomnia and so she really needed to get to sleep and stay asleep. And I hear her from the other room saying, it's like 11:30. And I was asleep. And she says, I think my water broke. And my first instinct was, that can't be true. It's 4 weeks early. It's also 11:30 at night, and I just got to sleep. Before I said anything, I thought maybe I should let Renee tell me what's going on with her body before I tell her what's going on with her body. I had very briefly do I have moments like that of wisdom and clarity, but that was one moment, and so my response was, "Oh yeah." Okay, are you sure? What made you? She said, yep, I'm definitely sure. It's my water broke. I'm going into labor. And sure enough, that is, of course, what happened. And we were completely not prepared. We had not had the, we knew where the nursery was going to be, but it was full of packages and gifts and things that were still in bags and things that were not quite made yet. And not ready for us to bring a child into. We were going to buy a car that week or the week after because we had 4 weeks. We were halfway through our prenatal classes of our 4 weeks of classes. We had made it through two of our 4 weeks. And so we told them that we were going to, we graduated early and we're doing a work study program on site. And, so all of these things happen, and it really took us off guard. But of course, the whole point of this is to say that it shouldn't be off guard because you know that it is happening. You are aware that these things are going to happen, so you need to be mindful. You need to be prepared, like the parable of Jesus and the young woman putting oil in their lamps and being ready for the thing that is about to come. And the way that Paul says that they are ready, he sets up yet another dichotomy. He says, you should be ready because you are children of the light. And though the culture around you, they are children of the darkness. Now, I'm always very mindful when I use or when I pull metaphors out of the scriptures that compare light to darkness. I think that there is and has been a history of these metaphors being misused and abused and being used in kind of racist and in white supremacist ways to say that this applies to people who are, that light is always better and dark is always bad. And so I'm very conscious of that. And that though that I don't think that Paul and Timothy and Silvanus were using that in that context and in that way, I'm sensitive that they have been used in that way. But what I want to kind of bring out from this metaphor of them is how much light meant understanding. Because if you think about a time before there was electricity, before there was lights on every corner, lights coming from every house, before there was that kind of what we call light pollution or just the way that cities were, and even before there was major collections of people all together that could share collective light, when it got to be dark at night, it got really dark. And when people couldn't see by sunlight or by fire, you couldn't see. And so this idea of not being able to see in the darkness, not being able to have an understanding of what was out there, could be an idea that was resonant as scary, as unknown. And so what Paul and the writers are trying to bring out is that you are not in this place of ignorance. You are not in this place of unknowing. You are aware. You have heard this gospel message. In fact, you are following this gospel message. You have heard all of the things we have told you, and so you have an understanding. You have an awareness that the people around you, that the culture around you that has not heard this message, they don't see that. They aren't going to be able to see the future that is ahead of them because they don't know what you know. And so then Paul makes, and the writers, they say, now that you know this, because you know this and are knowing what is coming, knowing that this new kingdom is upon you, that is coming with you, you need to have the qualities that come with this awareness. And he lists three things that also that Paul lists in other letters, like 1 Corinthians 13, that you might have heard, that these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. He also brings this up before then. Remember, this is the oldest book, the letter. And so he's developing this idea of this is what you need to have. You need to have faith, you need to have hope, and you need to have love. And he sets up this metaphor of armor, putting this on, of armor. And this metaphor is a little bit more elaborated in later letters, but in here he started to build this metaphor, and it's not completely out of the blue. It is actually based on Joel, the prophet Joel, who used this same armor metaphor, that what they need to fight for is not land, is not power, but what they need to defend themselves with is for their own souls. And so this is what will set them apart. This is how they need to act. They need to have faith in a God who has given them this word. They need to have faith through the word that Paul and Timothy and Silvanus have shared with them. They need to have what the writers called in chapter 1, they called a labor of love. Love not only in word, but in deed. They need to have love for one another. They need to have love for God, love for this word, this message that has been given to them. And they need to have a steadfast hope. And what he actually builds on that in this text says you need a hope for salvation. A hope for salvation. Which is to say that the love that they have is not in vain. It's not just something that they need to have without purpose, without goal. In fact, the love they have is guiding them towards something, that they will be saved through this work. It is their labor of love. And this labor of love leads to a hope of salvation. Now, I don't want to give a long diatribe about salvation and what salvation means, because I think it means a lot of different things. I think it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of people in different contexts. But what I would like to highlight in this idea of salvation today is the way that I think the writers mean it for this particular church is that their lives themselves will be a salvation. Let me give you an example of what I mean by that. When I was at First Baptist Portland, there was this man by the name of Benjamin. Not his real name, but a man by the name of Benjamin. And he would come into the what we call the drop-in center. And we had this drop-in meal every Monday and Wednesday. They had a commercial kitchen in the basement, and people would come down and they would make a hot meal every Monday and Wednesday, and anybody who wanted to could come and get a hot meal, no questions asked. And this person would come in on a regular basis, and then at a certain point he began to ask us, hey, do you guys need help? I was, oh yeah, we could always use volunteers. Okay, I'll be a volunteer. What do I do? Well, just come back on Monday at 9 and we'll put you to work. So he started volunteering. And he volunteered on a consistent basis, and then at a certain point he asked if there was a way that if the church was looking for workers, if there was any jobs that he could do. And sure enough, there was. We needed people to do some pickup for the drop-in center. We needed people to manage all of the inventory. We needed somebody to run the grocery program, because they also packed groceries as part of this citywide grocery packing program, and we were one of the stops where people could pick up groceries. And so this person was hired then, part-time, to work in this drop-in center. And when I was talking to him one time, I kind of got to know a little bit of his story. And without going into too much detail, let me just say that he needed something to do. Because without a purpose, his life went down these inevitable pathways where he sought belonging, he sought purpose, and these were through things that were harmful to him. Through things like drug use and addiction and other kinds of acts that we find that were not fulfilling, maybe in the moment, but didn't have a kind of a long-term fulfillment. And what he really found in this drop-in center was a purpose, was a sense that this was something he could do with his life. Every day he could come and he could participate and he could do something with his life, and it would give his life purpose, it would give his life meaning. And he felt that this was a God-send, literal God-given task for him. And it saved his life. Did it save his soul? Did it ensure his entry into heaven? Maybe. I don't know. I don't make that call. But what I do know is that it saved his life. And his life was now, because it had this, he was following this purpose, he was following the thing that he was meant to do, that God had given him to do, that his life was saved. And that is what I think Paul and Silvanus and Timothy are trying to say to the Thessalonians. They're saying, you need to do these things. And indeed, he says, you are already doing them, but you need to continue to do these things, not because of some grandiose goal that will happen at some point farther down the line, but because it will save your lives here and now, in this place, in this church. And because you are doing it, and because we can see the lives that are being saved through this, we have hope for greater salvation, for greater lives, for more people to have their lives touched and saved by this church. And for that, they give thanks. And so that's what this is, what their message was all about. And their final instruction for them in our scripture today is to build each other up. It's to continue to live as community, to encourage one another, he says. And he even says, even as you are now already doing. So we come back to this question, why were they so thankful for this church? Well, I think they were thankful because this church, the Thessalonians, they modeled what church was supposed to be about. And I want to echo that here this morning. I am thankful for this church, for Community Church of Barrington, because I think that you are modeling what church should be about. I'm thankful for the names that are on these banners, names of people who have set up an environment and a culture. I'm thankful for the ministers who have come before me, who have established all kinds of tradition, all kinds of groundwork, a foundation here. I was talking to people yesterday about ministers that they had remembered from before and all the work that they had done. And of course, it was so nice to see Azina again and to be reminded of all of the great work that she has done here and the impact that she has had. I'm thankful, just as the writers of Thessalonians were, for the ways in which you build each other up. The ways in which you build me up. I'm thankful every time somebody lends a hand, even though they weren't asked. Every time somebody supports a project, somebody has an idea for something, and they come and they say, there is this need, and everyone is so quick to lend a hand to fill that need. I'm thankful for your willingness to go into a future that is unknown. Not to keep cycling around doing the same thing over and over again, but to see time as something that is pushing towards something new, something different. I'm thankful for your eagerness to reach out to a generation that is trying to find its way and making space here. So I give you the same message that Paul and Timothy and Silvanus gave. Stay strong in your faith. Know that Jesus will do great things in our church. Do not lose hope. Love one another. Encourage each other and build one another up, even as indeed you are doing. And the people of God said,
Amen.